Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Sarah Stevens, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of Robert H. Hinckley and the Noble Foundation. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students practical politics and citizen involvement in the government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to visit our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is Reclaiming Our Democracy, Healing the Break Between People and Government. Today's guest is Sam Daly Harris. Sam Daly Harris is the CEO and founder of the Center for Citizen Empowerment and Transformation. He founded Results, a citizen lobby committed to creating the political will to end hunger and the worst aspects of poverty, and Results Education Fund, an organization focused on creating the will to end hunger and the worst aspects of poverty through education. Sam Daly Harris also co-founded the Microcredit Summit campaign in 1995. He is the author of Reclaiming Our Democracy, Healing the Break Between People and Government, which he will discuss today, that tells the story of Results. Please join me in welcoming our guest.
Thank you. Thanks. Thank you very much. It's a great honor to be here. I'm grateful to the Hinckley Institute for having me. I'm at the tail end of a 22-city fall speaking tour. Monday was University of Michigan. Tuesday was Oberlin College. This morning is here at the University of Utah. Tonight's BYU. Am I allowed to say BYU? Never mind. And then I red-eye Friday night back to Miami, Florida for my 50th high school reunion. And then on Monday, I go home to Princeton, New Jersey, and then Tuesday go to speak in Seattle. And then Thursday night, I red-eye back to Princeton for a lecture there, and then on the next day I go to Ottawa, Canada for a citizen climate lobby conference in Ottawa. So when people show up, I'm really grateful, and so I do thank you for coming. I want to start with two quotes. One quote is my way of thanking people. It's from the late Mark Hatfield, U.S. Senator of Oregon, who said, "We stand by as children starved by the millions because we lack the will to eliminate hunger. Yet we have found the will to develop missiles capable of flying over the polar cap and landing within a few hundred feet of their target." This is not innovation. It is a profound distortion of humanity's purpose on Earth. And I'm going to repeat that. Hatfield said, "We stand by as children starved by the millions because we lack the will to eliminate hunger. Yet we have found the will to develop missiles capable of flying over the polar cap and landing within a few hundred feet of their target." This is not innovation. It is a profound distortion of humanity's purpose on Earth, end of quote. And I use that quote to thank you because I say your being here is an expression of your commitment to correcting that distortion of humanity's purpose on Earth. The second quote, it's an old quote, but it's new to me. It's from Mark Twain. These are quotes by Mark Hatfield and Mark Twain. These are my Mark quotes. Mark Twain said, "The two most important days of your life are the day you were born and the day you find out why." And this talk and this book is a lot about the why. And I think in an introspective moment, we would all agree that part of the why we're here is contribute, to give back, to make a difference, to leave the campsite cleaner than we found it. The trouble is, all of those desires are smothered by layers of hopelessness, cynicism, discouragement, and despair. But when that stuff can be released, then our natural desires to contribute can come up. This is the 20th anniversary edition of the book, so 20 years ago I didn't say this, but if anyone happens to be tweeting, although you're supposed to have your handhelds off, you might use hashtag reclaiming our democracy. There'll be some book signing at the end and some tabling by results and Citizens Climate Lobby. The point about that was, it's my intention to inspire you this morning. Now, I haven't gotten to that part yet, but my intention is to inspire you, and that you, at the end of the talk, you'll say, I want to do something, or I want to do more, or I want to do some advocacy, or I want to look into it. And we'll have some folks that are working locally that could be important helps with all of that. There is a sign-in sheet, if you wouldn't mind. I'm going to start it right here, and if you could pass it around. And here's the last thing. The essence of this talk is not so much it's not the science of climate, and it's not actually about the victories on ending global poverty, although those are important. The essence of the talk is, how did the breakthroughs happen? How did people move from semi-hopelessness or deep hopelessness to some serious progress? And that's what the essence is. But so even though the issue isn't the essence, I'm still going to do a reading to presence the human part, the heart part of my topic. And so I'm going to read a brief excerpt. It's from a New York Times article that was on the front page of the New York Times above the fold about 6 years ago. Oprah Winfrey did an hour show about it. It's about child labor in Africa, and it's titled Africa's World of Forced Labor in a Six-Year-Old's Eyes. And so before I start this reading, I'm going to ask you to conjure up a six-year-old you might know, a brother, sister, cousin, grandkid, neighbor's kid, professor's child. Who is a six-year-old you might know? Here it goes. Just before 5 a.m., with the sky still dark over Lake Volta in Ghana, Mark Quadwo was rousted from his spot on the damp dirt floor. It was time for work. Shivering in the pre-dawn chill, he helped paddle a canoe a mile out from shore. For 4 more hours, as his co-workers yanked up a fishing net inch by inch, Mark bailed water to help keep the canoe from swamping. He last ate the day before. His broken wooden paddle was so heavy, he could barely lift it. But he rapidly followed each command from Quadwo Taki, the powerfully built 31-year-old in the back of the canoe who freely deals out beatings. I don't like it here, Mark whispered out of Mr. Taki's earshot. Mark Quadwo is 6 years old, about 30 pounds, dressed in a pair of blue and red underpants and a Little Mermaid t-shirt. He looks more like an oversized toddler than a boat hand. He's too little to understand why he has wound up in this fishing village, a 2-day trek from his home. But the 3 older boys who work with him know why. Like Mark, they are indentured servants, leased by their parents to Mr. Taki for as little as $20 a year. End of quote. It goes on much longer. I'm going to read the end. He's too little to understand why he's wound up in this fishing village, a 2-day trek from his home. But the 3 older boys who work with him know why. Like Mark, they are indentured servants, leased by their parents to Mr. Taki for as little as $20 a year. And I've read this. I could do it by heart, actually. I've read this to thousands of people. And every time I read it, I always end by saying, I am crystal clear. I am crystal clear that well-targeted microfinance, targeted to the very poor, and well-run, it's got to be both well-targeted and well-run, can help parents care for their children and not result to what I just described. And I say that because 20 years ago, I was with Muhammad Yunus of the Grameen Bank, and I asked him, what's the first thing a woman does with the profits from her micro-business? Expecting him to say, well, the first thing that she does is she puts her kids in school or she feeds the family better. No, that's not what he said. He said usually the first thing she does with the profits from her micro business is she brings her children home. She couldn't afford, at young as 5 and 6 years old, couldn't afford to feed them, and she'd put them out with other families to sweep or clean barely in exchange for a handful of rice. And the first thing she does with the profits from her micro business is she brings her children home. So we'll get to the bulk of this talk, but I'm going to ask a few questions first. The questions that I want to ask are for students only. So if you're not a student or an old geezer or anything like that, do not answer. I'm not interested. You can think the answer, but don't say it. So if you're a student, raise your hand really high. I should probably make people stand up. But raise your hand really high if you know the name of your U.S. representative, not your senator, governor, mayor, any of that. Your U.S. representative in Washington, either right here in Salt Lake, if that's what you're going to, or if you go somewhere else to home, your representative there. If you're absolutely sure you know your U.S. representative's name and you're a student, raise your hand really high. So really, really high, because I'll call on you. Oh, let's see. Really high. Actually, okay, go ahead right there.
Jason Chaffetz.
With that, okay, very good. I actually don't have my whole list in my head. Let's do one more. Who else? Raise their hand really high.
Could be Chris Stewart for the 2nd District.
Chris Stewart? Okay, very good. But still, if you notice, there was something like 5 or 6 or not a whole lot out of more than 5 or 6 in terms of who knew that name. Okay, my next question is just a show of hands. Let's do it. And for radio listeners, I'll let them know what the result was. I'm only looking for the students. The question is the end of poverty possible? Now, I know I'm at a university and you want to know the definition. No, I'm going for gut. In your own brain and your own gut, the end of poverty is either possible or it's not. You maybe not. You don't like your answer, but students, is the end of poverty possible? Yes, hands up, way high. We've got 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Okay, so 8, not possible. Raise your hand, not possible. We've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Okay, or about 12. So the not possibles win, actually. The bad news, if it's not possible, as I believe, you're going to hear that in a moment, there's no reason to do anything about it, because why would you do anything about an impossible thing? Although I thought it was impossible before I started this organization on ending global poverty. Is a stable climate possible? Yes, students only. Raise your stable climate possible. We've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. Not possible. No. Who's a no? No, come on. Don't be shy. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I didn't want to... 6, so it's almost, maybe. Okay, so I didn't want to talk you out of not possible if that was what was true for you. If you answered yes to either of these questions, and tell me this, can ordinary citizens create the political will to achieve the end of poverty or a stable climate? So if you answered yes, it's possible, now the question is, can ordinary citizens really... create the political will to those ends? Raise your hand if it's a yes. We've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. No. Who says an ordinary, honest guy back there? 2. Okay, thank you. Okay, very good. So I just have a couple of others. This is a question. We'll hand a microphone around about. The questions are, what's an issue you're passionate about? Can you make a real difference on that issue? And are you making the difference you want to make now? Okay, those are the questions. So if you know an issue you're passionate about, raise your hand, and we'll go one at a time on these three questions. You want to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Alice Riedessel. I'm studying social work here at the University of Utah.
And an issue you're passionate about?
Is human trafficking.
Okay, human trafficking. And can you make a real difference on that issue?
define real, but yes.
Yes, okay. Are you making the difference you want to make now?
Not quite.
Not quite. Okay, after you graduate, perhaps? Well, okay.
Yes,
who
perhaps.
Else? An issue that you're passionate about. I'm looking for someone else to raise your hand. Doesn't have to be passionate. Really, really interested in. Maybe it's not passionate. Who's got something? We've got right here. Okay. Introduce yourself.
My name's Nisha, and I'm also studying social work here at the U. And I'm not any expert, but I am passionate about the issue of hunger.
Hunger in the U.S., around
the
U.S. world, both? In the U.S.
Specifically.
Good. Can you make a real difference on that issue?
As a whole, not necessarily, but we do raise awareness through alternative breaks and stuff like that. I'm leading trips on hunger focus issues.
Perfect. So. Great. Okay. Are you making the difference you want to make now?
No.
No, not yet. Okay. Thanks. Let's leave it right there. Thanks to the two of you for helping us out with that. I just kind of want to bring people in to this talk. The first edition of the book focused on results, The Lobby on Ending Global Poverty. I'll do that first. The new edition of the book focuses, among other things, on citizens' climate lobby. I'll get to that second. There's also a new chapter on the Center for Citizen Empowerment and Transformation. And that's where it gets to the, how did the breakthroughs happen? How did hopeless turn into hopeful? How did, like, no action turn into breakthrough action? But I'm going to start with my own story, which is a story from actually obliviousness to hopeless to action. And so I have a bachelor's degree and a master's degree. Raise your hand if you don't know what I have a bachelor's degree and master's. You shouldn't know, really. Yeah, okay. I'm not even going to ask you to guess. I have a bachelor's degree and a master's degree in music. And I played percussion instruments in the Miami Philharmonic Orchestra for 12 years, and I taught high school music, and then I started a citizen lobby group on ending global poverty. And a lot of people asked, like, what was that about, and what motivated that change? And when I look back over my life, there are two experiences that come to mind initially. I graduated from high school in 1964, and I played timpani in the orchestra at the graduation ceremony. And just before the ceremony started, a flute player came back to the percussion section and told me that a high school fraternity brother, a year younger than I, had died the day before in a tractor-trailer accident in Georgia. And it was her next-door neighbor, so she knew before I did. And, you know, I know that there's a lot of people in the room who are close to 17. But when I was 17, mortality was irrelevant. I mean, I didn't even know what the word meant, actually. I mean, I had forever when I was 17. But during this period of the funeral and the mourning period, after the funeral, I went with my friend's younger brother to collect his report card from his homeroom teacher. It really began to dawn on me that maybe I had 17 more minutes or 17 more months or years, and the questions of purpose started to come up. Why am I here? What am I here to do? That Mark Twain quote, the two most important days of your life are the day you were born and the day you find out why. So 4 years later, college graduation day, Robert Kennedy is assassinated right around that day. And it's another one of those, it's 1968, it's another one of those, what is this life? What is this death? Why am I here? What am I here to do? No answers. But the question for this musician who's oblivious and hopeless, the questions are getting clearer. 9 years later, see, I'm kind of slow, actually. 9 years later, I'm invited to a presentation on ending world hunger, the Hunger Project. And I go into this thing thinking hunger is inevitable. You know, I was one of the ones who thinks it's not possible. I was one of those guys. Thinking hunger was inevitable because there were no solutions, I thought. Because if there were solutions, somebody would have done something by now. But I go, my little oblivious, hopeless self, into this lecture, and I realize there's the obvious. There's no mystery to growing food. There's no mystery to clean water, basic health, literacy. None of that stuff is mysterious, that I'm, in fact, not hopeless about the perceived lack of solutions. I'm hopeless about human nature. People will just never get around to doing the things that can be done to end poverty in this case. But there's one human nature I have some control over, actually, my own. And my question, why am I here? What am I here to do? And this gets to the end of the story. In 1978, I've stopped asking. In 1978 and 1979, I spoke to 7,000 high school students. I stopped asking, are you guys born yet? No. In 1978, 1979, I speak to 7,000 high school students. And before I go into the first classroom, I read some quotes from the National Academy of Sciences Food Nutrition Study and others calling for the political will to end hunger. So I asked 7,000 high school students what the name of their member of Congress is. I don't want to know if they met him. I don't want to know if they wrote him. Just the name. Anyone want to, who's not heard this story before? Okay, how many, you never heard this before. Out of 7,000, how many do you think knew the name of their member of Congress? We have an optimist over there. Five. Yeah, actually, 200 knew. Fewer than 3%, 6,800 didn't know, just over 97%. And results started out of this gap between the calls for the political will to end hunger on the one hand and the lack of basic information on who represented us in Washington on the other. We then didn't work with high school students particularly. We just learned this lesson working with high school students. What I'm going to do right now is I'm going to talk about a couple of victories in results, but the real issue is not the victory. Actually, in kids' lives, the victory is the real issue. But the issue of the book is more about how did this happen? How did these breakthroughs occur? In 1986, the volunteers in results generated 90 editorials, not letters to the editor or op-eds, there were more of those, but editorials where the Salt Lake Tribune or the Miami Herald or the Atlanta Journal said the Child Survival Fund should be tripled because 41,000 kids are dying every day from mostly preventable things. And we would get these editorials in the office and we'd mail them four at a time with a cover letter, five at a time, to 100 key people in Washington. Key members of Congress, the administration, UN agency leaders, nonprofit groups. And at the end of the campaign, the head of UNICEF, the late Jim Grant, took our cover letter and he scribbled, it wasn't scribble actually, he wrote a handwritten note in the margin. And he said, I want to convey my heartfelt thanks for the unflagging and satisfyingly successful efforts of results on behalf, because he was getting five letter editorials, four editorials, six editorials, constantly in the mail over the course of that year. Satisfyingly successful efforts of results on behalf of vulnerable children and mothers everywhere. I thank you in my mind at least weekly, if not more often, for what you and your colleagues are accomplishing, but I thought I should do it at least once this year in writing. So we've continued to lobby year in, year out, decade in, decade out. So the fundings jump from $25 million a year bilaterally to $600 million a year today. In a New York Times Online article, the former deputy executive director of UNICEF, Kuhl Gautam, was quoted as saying this year, to a great extent, it was because of the receptivity created by results that the U.S. funding for child survival increased so dramatically, starting in the mid-80s, and that led many other countries to come on board. So UNICEF was telling us in 1984 that 41,000 children were around the world were dying every day from largely preventable malnutrition and disease, things like measles coupled with malnutrition. Now, the latest statistics from UNICEF came out 4 weeks ago that the 41,000 a day has gone down to 18,000 a day. Now, still scandalously high, but you get the progress there. I mean, if you walk out on the street and ask someone, how's it going with global poverty? I mean, how about child mortality around the world? Oh, I think it's all getting worse. We're all going to hell in a handbasket. You know, I think that's what people might think off the top of their head and have no awareness of this kind of thing. One more, and I'm going to start getting into the underneath it. In 1987, Results Volunteers generated 100 editorials again on microfinance legislation for the very poor. In August of 87, Results Volunteers were able to get 28 editorial writers on a conference call with Muhammad Yunus of the Grameen Bank 19 years before he received the Nobel Peace Prize. And we're going to see, well, how the heck did that happen? In 2007, after getting the Peace Prize, he said, no other organization has been as critical a partner in seeing to it that microcredit is used as a tool to eradicate poverty and empower women than Results and Results Ed Fund's Microcredit Summit campaign. And there were about 1 million in 1986 with a microloan among the very poor when we started. There are some 124 million today. Again, something people have not much awareness of in terms of some progress. So what does it take to empower? This is the book. This is the lecture right here. This question, what does it take to empower citizens like this? Let me describe how volunteers were able to get 28 editorial writers on a call with an unknown guy, Muhammad Yunus, doing an unknown intervention, microcredit, from a little-known country, Bangladesh, that Henry Kissinger had called a bottomless basket case 11 years earlier, and get those editorial writers on the phone without Angelina Jolie or whomever kind of thing, just by asking. So I'm going to do a demonstration, and I'm going to be a volunteer in this demonstration. And it's going to be 1987, and it's going to be January, February, March, April, May, and June. And the ingredients, this is it. This is the postdoc piece of the lecture on citizen empowerment. The ingredients are group support. I'm a volunteer, and I'm in a group with four others or five others or six others. I've got a structure of support, which is this conference call, which I'll describe in a moment. And we're going to go deep. Going deep is another ingredient. And we're going to focus. We're not going to flit every 2 months. We're going to focus. So one component of the conference call is a guest speaker, hopefully inspiring, with some Q&A. So each month we can go a little deeper on the issue of microcredit and microcredit legislation. There'll be some grassroots victories, a volunteer in Los Angeles or volunteer in Provo or on the phone talking about what they accomplished. There'll be a learning a little talk, learning to be articulate. Like if you just understand the issue and you can't articulate it, you aren't dangerous yet to the condition of ignorance and apathy. And then after the call, we'll write a letter, maybe to our member of the House or Senate or whatever. So here we go. It's Saturday. I've got my four other folks around me. The conference call is starting. We have a guest speaker on microcredit legislation. Pretty inspiring. We have Q&A. There's some grassroots victories. We learn a little talk about microfinance for the very poor. After the call, we write a letter to our representative. I'm a volunteer. I'm inspired. On Monday, I don't do anything. I just forgot. I don't know. I was inspired on Saturday, but by Monday, I don't do a thing. So now it's February. We have a guest speaker, even better, Q&A. We have some grassroots victories. We learn a little talk. It's slightly different, slightly new information. Then we write a letter to our senator. I'm the same volunteer. I'm even more inspired. And on Monday, I call my editorial writer, and I call again on Tuesday, and I call again on Wednesday, and he never calls me back. So now it's March. We have a conference call guest on microcredit legislation. It's pretty inspiring. Q&A, grassroots victories. We learn a little talk, slightly new fact maybe added in. We write a letter to the other senator. I'm really stoked now, And on Monday, I call my editorial writer, and he picks up the phone by mistake. He thought it was, he was waiting for a call from someone else, and he thought it was that person, but it was me. He was slightly bummed that it was me, and he tries to get me off the phone, actually. But can you send me something, he says. And, well, it's 1983, so I 87, so I can't email it. So I get in the car, and I drive over, and I leave it at the front desk thing, and they send it up to his office. It's now the April call. We have a guest speaker on microcredit legislation. It's kind of inspiring. We have a Q&A, grassroots victories. We learn a little talk. We write a letter to the president, Ronald Reagan. Okay, so I'm really turned on. I call my editorial writer, and I ask him, can we meet for 10 minutes? Coffee, anything, downstairs in the lobby. He says yes for some reason. We meet for 10 minutes. It stretches to 25 minutes. And then he looks me in the eye and he said, you know, I'm not going to write about this. Why don't you write an op-ed? Well, I've heard all these guest speakers and Q&As and learned these talks and written these letters. I write a darn good op-ed. And in early May, it's published in the local paper. So we're on our May conference call guest, guest speaker, Q&A, grassroots victories. It's me now. I'm telling about the op-ed I got published. We learn a little talk, and we write a letter, let's say, to the editor. And then I get on the June call, and I hear that Muhammad Yunus will be a conference call guest in August. Well, I've pestered the editorial writer for 4 months now about he's certainly heard of him. He's a little guilty that he hasn't done anything yet. He really liked my op-ed, thought it was well-written. So he says, yes, I'll be on the call. Do you see that the focus, the going deeper, the support of my group, the structure of support helped me have that breakthrough? That if we had done microfinance in January and February and then switched to child survival in March and April and then switched to basic education in May and June and then switched to World Bank reform in July and August, do you see that I wouldn't have been able to pull that off? Is that clear? But that because I kept having time and I kept going deeper, I could pull that off. And so so now I want to look at how this methodology has been used more recently with Citizen Climate Lobby. I got a call in July of 2007 from a friend in Results. His name is Marshall Saunders. And he said, I saw An Inconvenient Truth, Al Gore's documentary on climate. I saw it 3 times in 10 days. And then I was one of the 1,000 that went to Nashville to learn to present it. And I went home to San Diego and I led the slideshow 43 times. He said, but early on I realized I was giving people 98% the problem and 2% what they could do about it. And that they couldn't buy enough Priuses or change enough light bulbs to make up for what the government was or wasn't doing. He actually said, I was reading the paper one morning, drinking my coffee, and I saw an article where Congress had approved $18 billion in subsidies for the fossil fuel industry yesterday, and the same day I'd gotten 18 people to change their light bulbs. He said, this is never going to work. So he asked me if I would coach him in starting Citizens Climate Lobby. And we worked a couple of times a week for months and months and months and once a week after a while. And let me give you a little sense of what they've accomplished. Their 6th birthday was last month. So 6 years ago last month, they didn't exist. And in 2010, their volunteers had 36, in U.S. and Canada, their volunteers had 36 letters to the editor published, 181 the next year, 537 last year, and in the first 10 months of this year, they've had 998 letters to the editor published on their issue, which is a carbon tax and dividend back to the public, with the tax back to the public. 20 op-eds in 2010, 39 the next year, 87 the next year, and 203 op-eds in the first 10 months of this year. 105 meetings with members of Congress or their staff in 2010, 255 the next year, 534 the next year. In the first 10 months of this year, they've had 669 meetings with members of Congress and their staff, including June meetings with Eric Cantor, the House Majority Leader, Paul Ryan, the budget chair, Mitt Romney's running mate. If you want greatness from volunteers, you must provide a great structure of support. And so you could be in this lecture and say, well, I heard this guy talk. He talked about a bunch of things, including conference calls. So I'm in a group, and why don't we go out and do conference calls? Well, I want to talk just for a moment about how you can do a conference call in a disempowering way and how you can do it in an empowering way. So the disempowering way to have a guest speaker is that you have 25 minutes for your guest speaker, and you let the guest speaker speak for all 25 minutes with no Q&A. That makes everyone on the call a bump on a log. That's disempowering. The empowering way is to insist that the speaker take 10 minutes and then have 15 minutes for Q&A. There, you remember when I said the section about grassroots successes? Well, the disempowering way is this way. If I'm a volunteer and I get on the phone and there are hundreds listening on the conference call, and I say, we had a meeting with our member of Congress yesterday. It was a blast. We can't wait to do it again. But I leave out the fact that it took 11 phone calls to get the, I leave that out, to get the appointment. And I leave out that we had to meet with the district director first. And I leave out that our knees were knocking before we went into, if I leave all that out, people around the country are on the conference call going, I don't know, we've made two calls already and we haven't gotten in yet. Maybe we should give up. No, the empowering way is to share the struggle. That means everyone else on the call can see themselves in this and then share the victory, which allows them to see themselves in that too. And the last thing is learning to be articulate. Most groups don't do webinars or conference calls. And if they do, they leave out anything related to being articulate. So skipping it is in disempowering. Or if someone does a role play, if like I do a role play with you and you're 200 people on the phone listening in and you're the congressional aide and I'm doing a role play, but it's terrible. I mean, everyone knows it's a stinker. But all that anyone can say is, thank you so much for volunteering. You were so courageous to volunteer. That's disempowering. Empowering is to do real coaching, some real insights in how to make the talk better. So what does it look like, empowerment and transformation at the individual level? I'm going to ask for a reader. I'm going to ask for someone who is or was a theater major. So I'm looking for a little kind of... Is anyone in the room is or a theater major? How about debate? How about... Yes. Oh, okay. Okay. So I'm going to ask you to read this. I'm going to set it up before you do. Go. You could pass that down there. Or you could come sit up here either way. This is a little excerpt from a woman named Ellie Sparks. Ellie Sparks is a Citizens Climate Lobby volunteer in the Richmond, Virginia area. This is really amazing stuff. So listen up to it. Ellie Sparks said before she joined Citizen Climate Lobby, she was suffering from climate trauma. She would read Bill McKibben's book, Earth, and she would weep at home, and she would weep at work. And then she joined Citizens Climate Lobby, and 18 months later, she's co-leading a workshop on creating relationships with members of Congress and editorial writers. And so that was a year ago, July. A year ago, August, she's on their national conference call describing the workshop. So this is Ellie describing the workshop on creating relationships. By the way, her member of Congress in this reading is Eric Cantor, the House Majority Leader, and the newspaper is the Richmond Times-Dispatch. So I'm going to key this up. Sure, if you can just... Speak up. There you go.
Our director, Mark Reynolds, likes to say, we're beating the farm on relationships. Then he tells us that we need to build relationships with members of Congress and editorial writers. Most of us, CCL volunteers, have never done that before. What in the world does a relationship with a member of Congress look like? How do we connect with an editorial page editor? Some of us have found models for those relationships in other parts of our lives. Gary in Boston uses the model of a work relationship. My relationship model is different. I adore romantic relationships, so I use romance as my model. That first meeting with the editorial writer, it's like a blind date, only you've decided beforehand you are going to marry this fellow.
Yeah, do you know anyone on campus who talks like this at all? It gets better.
You are going to be sweet and interesting, but not too intense. If it doesn't work out with the editor, you are going to marry one of his friends at the newspaper, the business editor, environmental writer, or city editor. Someone at this paper will find you interesting and compelling. It's just a matter of being persistent until you find the right connection. I see the relationship with a member of Congress as an arranged marriage. If you live in her district, the member's aide has to meet with you. That's what our congressman's legislative director, LD, told us in January. Since then, we've met 4 times with the LD.
Actually, now they've met 7 times with the legislative director in 18 months, and the 8th time was with Eric Cantor himself. Go ahead.
We schedule 45-minute meetings with him. He keeps us for well over an hour. He doesn't want us to leave. Why? Because a good arranged marriage starts out cold and heats up over time. That's different than a love match, which starts out hot and slowly cools down. I see the editorial page writer as a painter. His canvas is the editorial page. His palette is filled with letters to the editor, op-eds, and editorials. I am his muse, model, and assistant.
Again, have you heard anyone on campus say, you know, the editorial writer at the Salt Lake Tribune, I'm his muse, model, assistant.
I want him to fill his canvas with colors that I like. So I'll have my group send 3 to 5 letters to the editor whenever the opportunity arises. The more colors I put on his palette, the better chance of having him pick 1 or 2 of my favorite colors. Last summer, he printed 3 climate denier letters from international denier groups. At first, the denier letter felt like a blow to the gut. Then I dug deep for the love language. My editor was proud of his work in standing up for the climate. Those denier letters were in response to his own articles encouraging conservatives to help conserve the climate. He had been courageous in writing those editorials. He was getting national attention because of them. He was not backing down. I thought he might enjoy a pat on the back from across the nation. I called Gary in Boston, a scientist in New York, and our CCL director in California. All 3 sent letters. All 3 letters were printed. I guess I was right. My editorial page editor likes national attention.
Yes, and now this last section is supreme genius. And yes, it's just supreme genius. Go ahead.
During our conference, I met with 20 congressional offices. I met with many folks whose view of the world was very different than mine. Going into their office was hard. I had to let go of a lot of emotional baggage. I could no longer judge them or hold hostility in my heart towards them. I had to let go of my fear of climate change and my fear that they wouldn't listen to me. I had to center myself in love. Releasing fear and centering in love. This is sacred and profound work.
Great, thanks. Great job. The point is, where did she start? When she started, she was suffering from climate trauma. Yeah, and now she got to, this is sacred and profound work. I say that if I would ask most people to go meet with 20 congressional offices on global poverty or climate change or whatever, they would think that would be like dirty work or hopeless work as compared to what she said. This is sacred and profound work. So be outrageous. It's the only place that isn't crowded, as Anonymous said. Yeah, cynical is very crowded, and hopeless is super crowded. Outrageous as a citizen is not very crowded, so be outrageous. There's a drawing in one of the new chapters of the book, And on one side of the page is a small circle that's labeled your comfort zone. And to the right is a much larger circle that's labeled where the magic happens. Do you know what magic is? It's when you start suffering from climate trauma, and within some months your editorial writer at the Richmond Times-Dispatch is speaking up in favor of a carbon tax and dividend. That's where the magic happens. But you need to find an organization that can help you out of your comfort zone over to where the magic happens, which is why I've asked Results and Citizens Climate Lobby to table at the back of the room. I'm going to close with this quote, and I'm going to say it twice, but I don't want anyone checking me out. So this is from George Bernard Shaw's Man and Superman, and then we'll go to a few questions. He said, "This is the true joy in life, the being used for a purpose recognized by yourself as a mighty one, the being a force of nature instead of a selfish, feverish little clod of ailments and grievances, complaining that the world will not devote itself to making you happy. I am of the opinion that my life belongs to the whole community, and it is my privilege to do for it whatever I can. I want to be thoroughly used up when I die, for the harder I work, the more I live. Life is no brief candle to me. It is a sort of splendid torch which I've got hold of for the moment, and I want to make it burn as brightly as possible before handing it on to future generations." One more time. It always settles in differently the second time. This is the true joy in life, the being used for a purpose recognized by yourself as a mighty one, the being a force of nature instead of a selfish, feverish little clod of ailments and grievances, complaining that the world will not devote itself to making you happy. I am of the opinion that my life belongs to the whole community, and it is my privilege to do for it whatever I can. I want to be thoroughly used up when I die, for the harder I work, the more I live. Life is no brief candle to me. It is a sort of splendid torch which I've got hold of for the moment, and I want to make it burn as brightly as possible before handing it on to future generations. End of quote. I thank the Hinckley Institute, Jane Nelson, for your support of this event, and for all of you for coming. And we can move into Q&A right now. So thank you so very much. Who would like to start? We might take one or two questions and then one or two answers and then move on to some more. Who'd like to start? I'm taking questions, comments, and complaints. So any of those three categories I'm up for.
And just when you give your question, will you please say your name and then kind of give a little bit about yourself and then just speak clear in the microphone.
Hi, I'm Joe Andrade. I'm on the faculty here. And actually, Dave Fallon should be saying this, but I just want to be sure that everybody knows out in the audio world that Citizens Climate Lobby exists and is alive and well in Salt Lake and meets on the first Saturday of every month and would welcome many additional volunteers to feel the magic as well.
I hope all the questions are like that one. Good. Yeah, Scott, you want to just say a sentence about Results? I don't know if there's a phone number, but then we can go on to some actual questions.
Yeah, so
be thinking of your questions.
Results is very active here in Salt Lake City, and our group leader is Debbie Baskin, and love to have Debbie just give her contact information.
My phone number, I don't know if...
Go ahead.
It'll be available back here.
Okay, great.
That way.
That's fine.
Oh. My phone number is 801-657-2568. Again, it's 801-657-2568. I would love to have you give me a call. We would love to have you join us.
Thanks. Thanks a lot. Go ahead. Question right here. Is it going to be tougher than those two? Introduce yourself.
My name's Alice Riedessel. I'm in my fourth year studying social work here at the University of Utah. And my question is, first of all, I wanted to say thank you, and it was a very intriguing talk. I've been to a handful of Hinckley Institute forums, and this was one that caught my interest. Yes. And my question is, what is one of the biggest thing like struggles you've come up against throughout your efforts, and how have you overcome it?
All right. Okay. So, you know, I'm going to think just at the results front for starters. One of the biggest struggles is the hopelessness all around us. So it's like, you know, if I would walk out in the street and say, you know, can we talk just for a moment about creating the political will to end global poverty or domestic poverty? What are you, a crazy man? Yeah. You know, so there's so much discouragement and cynicism about that people can make any difference. And so you just keep putting it out there. I'm going to 22 cities and I'm asking for results and citizen climate lobby table at the back of the room in hopes that some people will kind of get the enjoyment about here and get involved. So that's one example. And yeah, thanks. Who else? Another question right here.
Hi, thank you. My name is Jennifer Daly. I work with the family physicians in the state of Utah, and I'm a lobbyist. My personal passion is addressing global health, but I wonder if you could speak briefly on the concept of addressing global poverty as an issue that can't be addressed just by addressing, you know, looking at healthcare or just by looking at hunger issues, that maybe figuring out ways to develop coalitions and this holistic way to look at mitigating or eliminating poverty?
I'm going to jump back to your question about, I think it was what's discouraged you, and it's going to then jump to your question. I've been asked a similar what's discouraged you, and I would also answer, well, the field of microcredit, microfinance, hit a fork in the road a long time ago, and one fork asks, what more can we do for the well-being of our clients? And the other fork asks, what more can we do for the well-being of our investors? And the fork that asks, what more can we do for the well-being of our clients other than making financial services available, sees our families are ill. We need to help with health services or education or whatever. Or then they look again and they say, oh, the kids are not in school. We need to form little makeup schools or catch-up schools. So I think part of the answer to your question, we observe when we look at a Grameen Bank or a BRAC in Bangladesh, which keeps adding on, oh, the seeds that they're getting are terrible. Let's make sure they have access to high-quality seeds. And on and on and on, and they keep saying it is, as you asked, you know, a bundle of interventions and not one or the other kind of thing. I don't know if that's useful. Good. Who else?
I think that's all we have. So on behalf of the Hinckley Institute of Politics, we'd like to thank Sam Daly Harris for giving us an excellent and informative forum. So thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. So, yeah. So there'll be books back there. I'll sign and sell some if you're interested. There's the results.